Hello everyone, hope you're doing great and welcome to this very special episode of the EK podcast. My name is Eric and with me today I have...
Me, Malin.
And me, Elin.
And we'll be bringing you this interview today as representatives of Ernst & Kai. Today we have the amazing opportunity to interview the 2019 Nobel Prize winner in chemistry, Professor Stanley Whittingham.
Whittingham won the Nobel Prize for his key role in developing the lithium-ion battery, being the first rechargeable battery patented in 1977. One requirement for winning the Nobel Prize is that you should have affected people's lives. Since the device you're listening on is most likely powered by a rechargeable lithium-ion battery, it is safe to say that his work has made a great impact on our lives.
We hope that you're as excited as we are for this interview, so if you guys are ready, let's welcome our Nobel Prize guest.
It's our great honor and privilege to have you with us today, Professor Stanley Whittingham.
Thank you very much.
Being awarded multiple prizes and last year being awarded the Nobel Prize on top of it all, I mean, it's an admirable journey. Where does your motivation come from, both in the beginning of your career and now?
I think initially it came from my teachers in high school. In Britain, I'm not sure about the Swedish system, but the last 3 or 4 years in high school, you specialize. So I studied physics, chemistry, and math. And I had two great teachers in chemistry and physics. Chemistry teacher was Major Lamb and Squibbs Bowman in physics. And they were excited about what they were doing, and they got me all excited.
How do you manage to keep your motivation after winning so many prestigious awards?
By having new young students come in every year who are excited about doing research and learning. Research is not easy. It has its ups and downs, and whenever you have a win, it's a great accomplishment and everybody's happy.
Yeah, I can believe that you have had many challenges as well. So it's admirable what you have achieved.
Thank you. I think most students don't realize research doesn't always come out the way you would like it to come out. So we used to have a summer program for undergraduates, about 18 undergraduates. I would say at the end of the summer, at least 3 said, research is not for me. Yeah. It doesn't go by the book.
So when did you figure out that you wanted to work with chemistry and wanted to earn a PhD in the field of chemistry and engineering?
As I said, it was really my teachers in high school, then I managed to get into Oxford. I went to New College, and I studied chemistry. And I had a couple of superb professors there. We call them tutors. So I met with them once a week for an hour, and they got me motivated. And Peter Dickens was my primary tutor, and so I did a year of undergraduate research with him. And that really got me interested in research and how you do research. So I managed to get an award to continue my research for my doctorate, at Oxford in that same lab.
So that was the beginning of the road.
That was the beginning of the road. And in a sense, what drives you is curiosity.
You're given the title as the key figure for the development of lithium ion batteries and discovered the intercalation concept for electrodes. It was the first functional rechargeable battery manufactured in the 1970s. What impact did this discovery have on this field at that time, and how did it affect your future research and the will to continue discovering new features?
I think I was very lucky. We did some exciting work at Stanford University. Then the oil company, which was then Esso, then went to Exxon, now ExxonMobil, they decide they want to be an energy lab, not just a oil and chemicals lab. So they asked a group of us to work in the energy field, but not in chemicals or oil. So we worked on superconductors. I did some chemistry there and found out we could store a lot of energy. So I said, well, hey, we can make lithium batteries. Exxon then decided that they would like to build electric vehicles. So they put a lot of money into the research operation, into engineering, and eventually into production of lithium-ion batteries. And shortly after we got going, there was that oil crisis in the 1970s, which gave an even bigger incentive to have alternative means of transportation.
Now, we talked a lot about how you got into the field of chemistry, but we want to know a little bit more how you got into the research field of just batteries. Was that something you were determined your whole life about and wanted to achieve? Or is this just something that you kind of approached during your quest for what you were supposed to actually major and specify in?
So at Oxford, I looked at some what we call tungsten bronzes. These are brightly colored oxides. Mm-hmm. In which ions move very fast. So we understood ion transport. Then I went to Stanford, and at that time Ford Motor Company had just discovered ionic motion in a compound called sodium beta alumina. And they talked about using that for a sodium sulfur battery, but that was going to operate at 300 degrees centigrade. So we looked at that material and measured its conductivity, how fast the ions moved. And essentially to do that, we built a battery that operated at room temperature. Mm-hmm. So we said, hey, we can do this at room temperature. We can make a battery that stores, you know, 5 to 10 times as much energy as a lead acid battery. And that really got us going. So I never set out when I was at Oxford to make batteries or get into batteries. I'm really a materials scientist, materials chemist. And you have to remember, back at the time I was at Oxford, chemistry had three departments. And I was in the inorganic chemistry department.
Yeah.
That included metallurgy and crystallography. So materials was really part of chemistry in those days. Yeah.
Last year, you won the Nobel Prize for your research. First of all, when did you know that you were going to win the Nobel Prize, and how did you react?
I found out 30 minutes before it was publicly announced. So I was in Ulm, Germany at the time. I'd given a keynote lecture that morning. I'd stepped out of the lecture hall, and the organizer there said, someone's been trying to get you on the phone from Sweden. Wait here. And I'll call them back and have them talk to you. So that was literally 30 minutes before they publicly announced it.
So what was the feeling? How did you feel when someone actually tried to reach you in Sweden for something that you might not have suspected before? What was going through your head?
Yeah, I wouldn't say we hadn't suspected it.
All right, yeah.
Because according to the press, they thought we were the favorites in, I think, 2015.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So people had rumored it, and universities prepared for it in 2015 and subsequent years. 2019, they didn't do anything. No plans were made. So I would say it wasn't a total surprise. The lady who lent me her phone said, I didn't seem particularly happy. That message, I think, was more shock than anything else. But then, no, it was a great feeling. And obviously, you know, everybody in the field is very happy.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I imagine it must have been fantastic.
Yes, and no. The meeting at Ulm was a large battery meeting, so everybody there was happy that, hey, they finally recognized us.
So we've actually taken a quote. It says that energy storage enables renewable energy. So how does the success with lithium batteries contribute to the challenge of renewable energy, in your opinion?
Well, you can't have renewable energy really to any great extent without storing that energy. Yeah. Remember, the wind blows, certainly in the US, mostly between 1 a.m. and 5 a.m. when you don't need electricity. And the sun shines, you know, in the daytime, and you might need it at dinner time to cook your dinner. I think you need to store it. And obviously the major means of storing electrical energy is pumped hydro. And there's large capabilities in New York State, Tennessee, and a few other places, but it's impossible to build any more of those these days. So the only way really of storing it is using batteries. And batteries can come in all different sizes. So you can have your little solar cells on your roof and store your own energy, or you can have large facilities where the batteries can smooth the energy, because remember, the wind doesn't blow steadily and the sun doesn't shine steadily. It goes up and down. It has to be smooth to get on the grid. So I think, you know, batteries are going to help there. And according to a Bloomberg study, I think last year, lithium-ion batteries now have over 90% of the battery storage on the grid. So they dominate the grid now. Mm. And we see now numerous plans going ahead throughout the states. New York State has a mandate of 3 gigawatt hours on the grid for the next 3 or 4 years. So everybody is building solar battery systems throughout the state.
Do you think that's the future?
Let's put it this way. They put a small battery storage system in my town next to a coal power plant. A month later, they turned the coal power plant off and it never got switched on again. So it really is going to help get rid of what we call these dirty peaker plants that maybe only run for 20 minutes, 30 minutes a day, yeah, and highly polluting. So I think it's going to happen. And I think it was during April that more electricity was generated by renewable energy in the United States than was generated by coal power plants. And I know Britain's done that for a while, but this is the first month it's ever happened. And it's probably partly due to the virus, because, you know, consumption's gone down. But for the utilities, it's now much cheaper to use solar power once it's in place than to use coal.
No.
So everything's going in the right direction. And I think it's important for folks like you and for when you have kids that we have a cleaner environment.
So going back, did you have any goals that you dreamed about reaching as a student? Because you mentioned earlier that you weren't really set on batteries at first. So did you have any other goals, or what did you think that you would be doing later in your life?
Well, I wanted to enjoy myself. I wanted to do what, you know, what I like doing, and science lets you do that. Particularly, I think, academic science. You can work around the clock or you can take a day off it. It's up to you, and it's real challenging. The other big plus is you can travel the world. So I think certainly when I went through college, you know, I was at Oxford, and I decided, no, Oxford is somewhat like Sweden in the winter, a little cloudy, cold and dark. So I decided, no, I would go and spend 2 years in California, find the sunshine and see what the rest of the world was like. Mm. And as a chemist or a scientist, you can do that.
It gives you a lot of options.
Yeah.
So that's a bit motivational for us who still goes to university. But do you have any other advice for us students who's dreaming about doing their own research in the future?
You've got to do what you like doing.
Hmm. Mm.
Don't do things for the money. You'll be unhappy. In the short term, you may be happy, but long term, you'll probably be unhappy. And be curious. Now, let curiosity rule and use your imagination. No, facts matter, but you've got to imagine totally different things. Don't necessarily go by the book, and don't be afraid of making mistakes. If you're doing research, you're going to go down a few wrong roads. You can correct those and go down the other ones. But if you're very conservative, you won't make any breakthroughs and you won't get super excited about what you're doing.
If you are a student now again, knowing your achievements and your revolutionary discoveries, would you have done anything differently?
It's difficult to say because times are very, very different. Remember, I was brought up in post-World War II.
Yeah. Yeah.
There was rationing of food. There was no internet. And until I was a teenager, there was no TV. So in a sense, I had a semi-perfect career. I went to a very good high school, Stanford School, which is in Lincolnshire. Then I went to Oxford, and then I went to Stanford in California. Mm. And then I went to one of the best corporate research labs in industry, and that was Exxon. A lot of things have changed now. You've got the internet there. Industry is not doing the same level of basic research they did when I was there. So it's difficult to say. No, a lot of my students now going to startup companies. know, they find that challenging and interesting, and then they may go to a more secure job later on. But the opportunities are totally different these days.
It's very interesting that you mentioned the history and how society has changed over time, because I thought it was very interesting, because in your Nobel Prize banquet speech, you said many centuries ago, Thomas Edison made many remarks about batteries, one of which was, there is a way to do it, better find it. And I would like to say that we have found it. I mean, wow, that's so... How does it feel for you that your discoveries and batteries have such impact on the world over the years?
Oh, it's great. No, we accomplished things you could never dream of that when you start out. Yeah. So it was just, no. We like doing science. We want to make things happen. You know, the lithium battery enabled all these, I shouldn't call them toys, all the smartphones. Sony put them in there. Devices initially, but without the lithium battery, you wouldn't have your smartphones and all the other devices you carry around with you. So we're all very happy, and it feels very exciting because people still want to make it better. We'd like to see all the vehicles, say in Stockholm, in London, New York, all be electric, so it doesn't pollute the downtowns. So everybody in the field's happy. It's unusual in your lifetime you see something come from nothing to, as it were, dominate and change the, people's lives.
Because, I mean, it must be amazing to, for you to just walk down the street and see someone with a smartphone or anything and know that they are using the battery that you developed.
Yes, it's even greater when I see the electric vehicles come down the street. The difference now is I cannot go shopping or walk down the street without people knowing who I am. That wasn't the case a year ago.
And do you think that lithium batteries will be used as frequently as today in, say, 50 years?
Oh, I don't know what will happen in 50 years. Yeah. Certainly in 10, 20 years, lithium batteries are still going to dominate because they store the most energy in a given space or for a given weight. So if you're not going to go away from lithium batteries, I think, for your smartphones and things like that. I think maybe 5 years ago, people thought about using methanol fuel cells for smartphones, started working on it until the FAA, which is the aircraft control system, saying you're not taking methanol on any plane. So that stopped all that research.
Now, you also mentioned earlier in the podcast that you said that research is not really an easy job. Like you're going to struggle a bit. Maybe sometimes it goes great, sometimes it's very hard. But how do you face challenges in research? How do you usually cope with them?
You should always have a plan B, I think. And when my students do their doctorates, I tell them, no, you define what your main program's going to be, what you want to do, but also have an alternative one that you're working on side by side. So if you get stuck on one, then you can go to the other one. And then maybe you'll come up with a solution for the first one. It'll just come out of your mind in the middle of the night or something. But always have an option. Don't go down a dead end.
What was your alternative?
At Oxford and when I was at Exxon, we're also working on catalysts. It's some of the same materials we use for battery materials are also the catalysts used in oil refineries. And initially at Oxford, my undergraduate work, we're looking at these same materials. But there, we're looking at how did oxygen atoms recombine on their surface, because that was in what we call the Sputnik era before your times.
Yeah.
And the US was trying to catch up on Russia on space shuttles and the likes. So you just keep your options open. And I worked on superconductors in my time and other things. It's whatever, if you're a scientist of some exciting area, you can quickly switch to it if you're flexible. And I tell my colleagues, be flexible. If something's exciting, jump on it. And try to lead the train, don't follow it.
You mentioned your colleagues and so on. Throughout your career, did you get inspiration from other researchers and scientists. And I mean, you got awarded the Nobel Prize alongside Akira Yoshino and John B. Goodenough. So how has that cooperation been?
Right. Scientists usually do not work alone. So at Exxon, we were in a group of, I think, six scientists and engineers, all with a slightly different background. So you bounce ideas off one another. Physicists think slightly differently than the chemists, and you may get a roadblock and they'll come up with a solution. I run a large research center here at Binghamton, and we have colleagues from San Diego and the West Coast, Cambridge in England. So there's about 10 different groups. So we work together, the theorists, the experimentalists. So we all bounce ideas off each other. You don't really want to work by yourself because you can get yourself in a rut. So my experimental students happily work with students in theory, students working at the large synchrotron facilities around the world. So everybody works with everybody else. So we try not to work just alone. It doesn't work nearly as well.
So if we go back to winning the Nobel Prize, how has that affected you personally? And how has it affected your career and your team and your research?
Obviously, it affected me personally quite a lot because there'd been rumors, I said it was going to happen, but until that happens, you don't know. Your life really changes. You're no longer really, in the same sense, in control of it. So everybody wants you to go everywhere. Everybody knows who you are. So it was the day I won it, I think, was late morning in Germany. All the press were outside the meeting room within, I think, 30 minutes. So Reuters, AP, and everybody else were there. The university set up a press meeting that evening back here in Binghamton, and I was on internet from my room in the hotel. So there are a few hundred people there. I had press calls all the time until the following morning when I took the train back to Frankfurt to fly back to the US. It's changed many things. As my wife said, no, you won't be the same now. And it turns out my grandson was the first member of the family to hear about it. So it must have been about, for him, he was in Idaho, must have been about 2 a.m. for him. Somehow he found out. So they were the most excited, the grandchildren, I think. Yeah. So, and they all came to Stockholm. Affecting my career, I don't think it'll have all that much effect at my age. John Goodenough and I have worked together on meetings over the years, and we're both part of what we call a Battery 500 consortium, which has been going on for 3 years now. So we work together again. We hadn't worked together for 20 plus years, actually doing research work. Kira Yoshino, I'd met him in a few meetings, but he was an industrial scientist, so he didn't publish all that much, and he didn't come to all that many meetings. But I'd met him a couple of times in Japan, maybe 10, 15 years ago. So obviously I met them both again this year in Sweden, and I was very happy at the Nobel lecture. A group of students in the Erasmus program drove all the way from Warsaw to listen and be part of it, because I previously had a student who went into that program. You should probably ask my students what effect it has, because I think they're the most excited.
So, as you said before, in 2015, you were nominated, or you were close to getting the Nobel Prize back then. You've currently got it, but are there any other projects or works over the years which maybe not have got the Nobel Prize, so everyone is aware of them, but you think should have won, or something that we should look out for in the future?
It's very difficult in chemistry to judge that. I think I may be the first real chemist who's got the Nobel Prize maybe in 5 or 6 years. If you look at the chemistry prizes, often gone to the medical area, biochemical, medical areas. People say things like the MOFs might get it. There's a few other areas which are somewhere between chemistry and medicine that also might be involved. It's very, very difficult to judge it. we were clearly happy. You know, we read what Nobel wanted the prize to be given for, had to impact humanity. And we say, perhaps we've been saying for years, this is something that has impacted all of humanity.
Do you have something, I mean, earlier we talked about advice for students, but do you have anything you would like to say to all the students who now are maybe at home studying and try to find motivation? What should they think about?
I think still try to work with others. Get on your favorite meeting platform. Talk to each other, bounce ideas off each other. No, just look forward to things changing. You just have to keep your chin up and dream about the future, what you want to do. I tell my students, you've got plenty of time now to plan your next experiment.
Yeah.
Which is the really exciting experiment you'd like to do that will give you all the answers you want. So you've now got time to think about things. You don't have to rush in the lab.
It's been a privilege talking to you. And thank you so much for taking the time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for this nice discussion. And please enjoy your lives, okay?
Thank you.
You too.
And good luck with your future research and everything.
Thank you.
We really hope that you enjoyed this episode. And looking back to what Thomas Edison once started many centuries ago, one can really say that Whittingham took on the challenge with great success. But the advances on rechargeable lithium-ion batteries also bring on the next chapter for the development of the field of renewable energy and contribute as a step towards a sustainable future. The music in this episode was made by Oskar Svensson. Thank you for listening, and hope you'll have a beautiful day.